And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. We're always bringing you the sources you don't ordinarily get to hear in the corporate media. Last week, I promised you we had something special coming up. Indeed, we do. We have author, academic, and journalist Maximilian Forte here on the line with us to discuss his indispensable new book, Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. Easily one of the most important books of the year and an absolute necessity at this historical juncture. So, Professor Forte, thanks so much for being on the program with us today.
Thank you, Brendan. It's great to join you once again.
Well, I told our listeners we'd have something special, and it's a great way to close out our year, the last program of the year, on this book, which has come at the most perfect time that it could be published, as we're in a lead up to another war, potentially much like what occurred in Libya. I mean, you must have been in an amazing rush to create this opus. It's not often we get a treatment of a U.S. war just a year or so after it happened.
No, you're right. I mean, it was a rush, but one that came actually many months later than it was expected or than it was due by the publisher. It was actually an enormous amount of material to have to digest and process and to develop into, you know, a sort of coherent story. But you're right, the overlap that is that we're witnessing right now with Syria, I mean, there are important points of difference, but it's something quite startling. And some of the familiar justifications and some of the same actors are all being lined up, preparing for what seems to be, well, an intervention has already begun in Syria. It's not like there has been none. There's been supply of weapons and even fighters by a number of countries. But in terms of a direct U.S. and Western European intervention, we seem to be in the preview stages of that.
Yes, the preview stages. And that's something we got to witness in the case of Libya as well. And I know you had to clear through a lot of material in this information age. There's more information coming to us, but it also means more to sort through. But we were certainly presented with a rush of information in the lead up to the war with Libya. It was just bang. There wasn't much time for the anti-war movement to mobilize or for people to get a clear picture of what was going on. I mean, the narratives were already in place to make the intervention happen.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I mean, that's kind of one of the startling things about the whole experience is that within the very first days of the street protests that occurred in mid-February of 2011, virtually everything that would be significant in producing the intervention was put into place. The justifications for it, the accusations of genocide, the calls for a no-fly zone, the question of the presence, the alleged presence of African mercenaries, which was later proved to be totally false, getting resolutions passed at the UN Security Council, key figures in the Libyan government, especially diplomats based overseas, defecting, websites popping up out of nowhere, organizations being formed within a matter of days, and so on and so forth. And within a few weeks of the first protests, you had the actual beginning of the NATO campaign. But well before that, still within February of 2011, according to the New York Times and ultimately the White House itself, the United States had already sent in CIA and Special Forces personnel that were on the ground in Libya at the very latest by late February of 2011. So yes, it was a tremendous rush. If the purpose of the rush was to leave people disoriented, confused, and more willing to accept the claims made by the authorities, then it was a very clever sort of move, certainly much more clever than what has been going on with Syria, where we've had more than a year now to digest what is going on and to really pick things apart.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, Syria, it's been a bit of a tougher nut to crack, I suppose, and it's given more time to evaluate the situation. Certainly in the case of Libya, there was so much uncertainty and ambivalence as to whether NATO was present, whether there had been forces on the ground. But now, of course, the facts have come out afterwards that there had been a rather early presence by NATO. But the other things were in place, as you said. You well documented, I think the Twitter accounts even were set up basically as of February 17th to start going ahead and promulgating certain viewpoints.
That's exactly right. And especially to create a kind of an online momentum, seeking, how can I put it, currying favor from Western public opinion, to build a sort of popular support for intervention and for recognition of what was known as the National Transitional Council, which is no longer officially in power in Libya, to have them recognized as, you know, again, the sole legitimate representatives of the Libyan people and so on. So yes, the media campaign in terms of, how can I put it, producing misinformation through mainstream media, but also a kind of organized and coordinated social media campaign, both were present from very early on.
And most of it was in English, directed towards a Western Anglo audience. Now, there's so much familiarity here. I mean, when you have Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama recognizing somebody as the legitimate opposition, you know there's danger afoot. And I think you had a very good sense of the imperial vocabulary. You know, you could almost use your book as a primer. Here's some of my favorites that you pointed out. There's Gaddafi must go, or killing his own people. These are phrases used in the West and in the propaganda and Twitter. You've got standing idly by. We can't stand idly by. I think that was the favorite in your book. You referenced that quite a lot. So,
yes.
You know, just like in the case of Assad, for example, Assad must go. Assad is killing his own people. We can't stand idly by while Assad, while Saddam, while Milosevic, whoever the case may be.
That's right. And in fact, that's a good point that you make, because they're building on foundations and precedents that were set earlier, both with the war against Serbia, over Kosovo, and the war in Iraq. Gaddafi had the extreme misfortune of being possibly the most demonized foreign leader among Americans anyway, ever. Much more than Saddam Hussein, because the demonization of Gaddafi occurred decades before it began with Saddam Hussein, or at least years before it began with Saddam Hussein, and possibly more so than even Fidel Castro. I mean, Gaddafi was painted by all kinds of American leaders, Carter, Ford, Nixon, all of them, you know, as subhuman was one of the terms that was used, as a dog. As a mad dog, as someone who was basically insane, as someone who posed a threat to the entire world. So for a couple of generations, Americans had been trained to think of Gaddafi in the worst possible terms. You know, he was not a member of humanity anymore. So all of that helped, of course.
Yeah, there was a sort of bipartisan consensus on Gaddafi, and it was more than just bipartisan. It extended throughout the Western world, and the way Gaddafi was portrayed, we're probably familiar with. Mad Dog, I think that was Reagan's people who came up with that one.
That's right.
But even, wasn't it Back to the Future back in the 80s? They had some Libyan terrorist bad guys trying to steal the time machine car. I can't remember specifically, but they were everywhere.
Yes, I mean, that's right.
They were inserted into everything. And one of the points that you make in your book is that that situation never really changed. We heard about a rapprochement between Gaddafi and the West starting in this millennium, around maybe 2003 in particular. But I think one of the points that you really want to stress here, that you're trying to stress, is that this ambivalence, hostility from the United States to Gaddafi never abated, even when Gaddafi made overtures towards them. I think that has a lot to do with the domestic and foreign policy that was adopted in Libya. And it's quite a mouthful, quite a lot to think about. But I think you're one of the only authors in the English-speaking language that's written recently about what Gaddafi's policy was actually trying to achieve, its objectives, potential contradictions. There is this Africanism, a Pan-African policy, yeah, that had implications both within Libya and outside of Libya. Can you tell me about his general or broad goals that he was aiming for in the last decade or two?
Yes, well, in fact, you're right to point out to some of those contradictions. And I have seen a few too many authors, including fairly well-respected ones, each making a point that I found to be, when I looked more closely at the kind of documentary base that exists, to be a rather simplistic and unconvincing assertion that Gaddafi was in bed with the West since 2003. And usually it's put in those terms, too, that he's in bed with the West. And of course, if you take that line of argument, in that case, the United States had no reason to intervene in Libya, except that they had this kind of moral outrage at these tremendous human rights abuses that were occurring. So you start having to buy into that argument if you're going to say that Gaddafi was in bed with the West. But when you look at it more closely, there was consistent and constant tension and friction and mistrust and suspicion between the Gaddafi government and the United States. The United States diplomatic cables make that painfully clear. There are numerous instances, and I document them in the book, where Gaddafi prevented foreign investment by American companies, especially in the construction sector in Libya, which is hugely profitable, with $150 billion being invested in construction, and certainly more lucrative for American companies than oil, most likely. And so I found that was a bit simplistic. If Gaddafi, if you want to use a bed metaphor, let's put it this way. Gaddafi was the one who was buying the bed and paying for the sex. And that means that the European leaders and so on that appeared to be kowtowing to him, those were the prostitutes, not Gaddafi. Gaddafi was very much in the driver's seat. It's also said that Gaddafi was collaborating with the U.S. in its war on terror, and that's factually wrong. That's factually wrong because Gaddafi was fighting al-Qaeda for years before al-Qaeda began to become public enemy number one in the United States.
Yes.
In fact, the very first international arrest warrant issued for bin Laden was issued by Libya, not by the United States.
Seems there are a whole lot of people fighting al-Qaeda before the U.S. deigned to do so.
Absolutely. And al-Qaeda was a sworn enemy of Gaddafi and wanted to see him removed at all costs. And here is a moment where NATO's intervention provides an opportunity for, you know, convergence and basically tacit collaboration at the very least.
It's something to think about with regard to what's going on in Syria. But, you know, I think the people who adopted the idea that Gaddafi was in bed with the West, I mean, they put forward a testable hypothesis, and that was that the U.S. would not intervene, it would not attack Libya, because they were partners and they were together. So, I mean,
that's right. And in fact, you know, interesting that you chose that particular point, because that was a key concern for a number of officials in Gaddafi's government, including Gaddafi himself. The idea of having a treaty signed with the United States that would commit the United States to never attacking or invading Libya, now that they were supposedly normalizing relations. And the United States consistently refused to sign any such document. So it's a way of signaling to the Libyan leadership, you know, people might think we're friends, but you and I, we know better. We've got our eye on you. We'll allow some of our business interests to invest in your country if you allow them. But let's not get too carried away with things. We're still not exactly chums. But you also mentioned about Pan-Africanism. I don't know if you want me to talk about that for a few.
This is where there's no distinction between foreign and domestic policy in any country, but in particular with Libya. This was the crux of a lot of issues. Now, you said keeping an eye on you, and that's what a large part of your book covers, and that is the United States was keeping very close tabs on many actions with regard to the Libyan government, because it was conducting a policy of certain aspects of construction and diplomacy in Libya that was being watched very closely by U.S. ambassadors and diplomatic personnel, the ever-shrinking core of diplomatic personnel, as you point out.
Mm-hmm.
And this came out through WikiLeaks. It came out in a variety of ways. So what are these actions in particular that caused so much consternation and drew so much attention from U.S. officials?
Yeah, and in fact, they wrote about certain things in their cables to each other, that is, the diplomats, much more that attracted their attention much more than anything to do with human rights. And that had to do a lot to do with the growing evidence of Gaddafi being able to win a great deal of support across Africa and of being positioned as a Pan-African leader, the likes of which had not been seen on the continent since Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah, and that he was financing and organizing and mobilizing all kinds of initiatives to form much deeper integration, economic integration, even ideas of a collective military self-defense and so on, that concerned the Americans. And so the Americans were studying every little, even what appeared to be in terribly minute and trivial details about arrangements that Gaddafi would make to suit his African guests when they were visiting Libya. And, you know, it comes down to American officials sidling up to some of these African diplomats and asking them, you know, about the quality of the breakfast and the bed linens and that sort of thing. It's, you know, I'm hardly exaggerating. Anyone reading the book would see that. And because they were very concerned about how he was able to do something that the Americans couldn't, or that the Americans couldn't do well, and that was to project soft power and win a great deal of legitimacy and so on. And Gaddafi was very successful at doing that. There's no denying it. And that obviously was a concern for the United States, and it's not just conspiracy theory. It's documented in various reports where they identify Libya and China as the two major adversaries of American interests in Africa.
Well, you've caught two issues there. I guess the first is that the cables and documents that you refer to in the book, it shows U.S. officials who understand the power of symbolism.
Yes, that's right.
If you have a hotel and the African dignitaries are given better accommodations than the foreign, Western, and EU dignitaries, that was noted.
That's right.
The U.S. wrote it down and cabled it to each other. And this is,
so they exactly. understand.
Because
he was putting African guests in luxury hotels and the American and European guests on foam mattresses in apartment blocks that had yet, you know, the construction had yet to finish.
Yes.
So you can imagine the kind of setting. Also not really looking after their transportation needs too much and so forth, but, you know, bending over backwards to appeal to the African guests and then having military parades and announcing to his African guests, you know, look at all of these armaments and so forth on display. They are all at your disposal should you need to defend yourselves against foreign attack. Don't think of them just as Libyan military hardware and so on. So those sorts of things really concern the Americans. Well, the Americans had to their advantage, and this the diplomatic cables reveal to some extent as well. What they had to their advantage is the fact that Gaddafi was leagues ahead of many of his own countrymen and women in terms of his Pan-African ideals, that there are many, many Libyans who simply despised the idea of Libya being realigned as an African nation, adopting an African identity and opening its borders to migrant workers from across Africa. That caused an enormous amount of resentment and incredible violence on a number of occasions. And I think that is what laid the seeds that really set everything in motion towards his eventual overthrow.
Yes, there's a lot at stake here, a lot at stake within Libya and outside of Libya at that particular time. And a lot of people, I mean, I and people I know, were not paying particular attention to Libya in the last few years. And at the time of the intervention, you heard funny things like, Gaddafi hasn't done anything in the last 20 years except sit there and talk. It's all hot air. And I don't want to pass judgment on his policies one way or the other, but it seems that the United States was passing judgment, and it seemed that they believed there was a lot at stake. I think you referenced certain documents. I got one here. It's called the AOPIG report.
That's a good one.
What an appropriate title. It's the AOPIG report, and that talks about U.S. goals in Africa. There's U.S. goals in Africa. There's NATO goals in Africa, closely related. So what are the kind of things that the U.S. and NATO were looking to achieve in years leading up to the 2011 intervention? I think you had identified a lot from about 2009 onwards.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the key points, as always, is having strategic access to African minerals and oil reserves, especially critical to the United States' own defense industry, for example. A lot of the minerals that they rely upon to build everything from jets to communications equipment and so forth can either only be found in Africa or the largest suppliers are in Africa. Also identifying the Gulf of Guinea as being a zone of especial interest to the United States in terms of oil imports. And the fact also that African economies were beginning to grow at a rate that outstripped those of many other countries in other parts of the world, then the move towards greater financial and economic independence, even communications independence, launching their own satellites again, thanks to Libya, developing things such as the African Monetary Fund, where the IMF and the World Bank were told to take a hike. They would not be allowed even observer status, let alone being involved in any projects of any sort. And Libyan investments that were totaling billions of dollars across the continent and certainly rivaled the investments and aid of the United States. And this is Libya. This is Libya with 6 million people, right? So the United States is obviously at a considerable disadvantage on this front, and it recognized that fact. But as I said before, really, the serious Achilles heel in Gaddafi's own policy is the fact that I don't think he had realized how much greater education his own people needed to be prepared for this kind of African future.
People weren't doing too badly in Libya, development-wise or economically, in terms of the indicators that were available.
But not at all.
The issue, as you point out, was how investment should be directed within a growing Libya. And this is a key issue. You point out Libya was sort of straddling geographically forces of world historic importance. At a time, just when the economy is starting to run into serious trouble, its economy is still growing. Its foreign investment is spreading across Africa. You kind of painted a picture of a Libya in constant motion. And the problem here is that it's involved in key economic areas and opportunities at a time of crisis and desperation in Europe and among NATO. So they're kind of looking at Gaddafi as standing in the way because he's trying to build these parallel African institutions. And whatever you might say, and I kind of sound like whenever anyone talks about wars and interventions, whether it be in the case of Iraq or Afghanistan, people in the West, such as myself, distance themselves from whoever's being attacked, whether it's Saddam or and so you say, whatever you might say about this fellow, whatever you might say. In this case, I'm not going to pass judgments here. I'm just going to point out there were these parallel institutions that Gaddafi appeared to be investing in. There was this belief that he could embolden and enhance the ability, the operating capability of the African Union and affiliated institutions in a number of ways. And I can't assess how viable or not viable those ideas were, but they were present and they seemed to be interfering with U.S. goals in a number of respects. You mentioned, I think Bechtel was rejected once or twice, and that
absolutely
the diplomats heard about that one. So
yes,
but that there's a number of ways in which the United States was irritated by these goals and these policies within Libya. Again, you make strong reference to this. The policy of foreign investment in Africa, that was seen as money leaving Libya. Likewise, the importation of foreign labor. There was a lot of jobs that needed to be done in Libya, a lot of development projects. That meant importation of people from all over Africa. And all of these policies, they had a reaction within Libya.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the complaint that one hears, and often it's not properly contextualized or it lacks further elaboration, was that there was high unemployment in Libya while millions of workers were being brought in. I mean, even with neighboring Egypt, Libya was a major source of employment support for the Egyptian economy. I'm not one that they are going to easily regain either, with Libya being in disarray as it is now. But the thing is that that question about Libyan unemployment, unemployment in Libya under Gaddafi is not like unemployment in a lot of other countries, where it can either mean a death sentence virtually, where you have no social support, or where you do have some kind of unemployment assistance, you're living in poverty. This did not mean that Libyans were living in poverty. It meant that they were idle. And they were idle in large part because there were a great many jobs that they simply refused to do, that they identified as being menial tasks and so forth. So it's a lot more complicated a story than just Gaddafi having opened the borders a bit too wide and having allowed in too many people. There was certainly that complaint, and Gaddafi was aware of these complaints, and that caused him to adopt these contradictory policies. At different times, you know, open borders, and at other times trying to crack down on what they called illegal immigration and so forth. And in fact, that's really one way of analyzing how Gaddafi operated in terms of domestic policy, as a person who was constantly bifurcated, you know, a person who was split. He knew that Libyans had a demand for a much sort of a wealthier lifestyle comparable to that of people in the Gulf states. He was aware of that. He tried to cater to that, but personally, he found that kind of thing distasteful. He preferred the kind of austere and Spartan living of, you know, a Bedouin in his tent out in the desert, that sort of thing. So there's this constantly being pulled apart in different directions and swinging from one policy to another during the course of his governance, you know, from, as I said at one point in the book, from artificial austerity, and austerity that didn't need to be put in place, to lavish spending and so on. But the idea that Gaddafi had done nothing is a very bold, and I'm going to say it, a very bold lie, that his successors in Libya should be kind of embarrassed about of making, because they themselves are right now having to call back in all the construction companies that left during the war. Now, what were these construction companies doing in Libya to begin with, if Gaddafi was doing nothing, if he wasn't building schools and apartments and so on, which were to be given away incidentally? And in fact, in the days of the early days of the protest, he gave away several thousand apartments that were immediately occupied by people, and so on. So, I mean, it is a very serious misrepresentation to say that he was doing nothing.
What I'm getting here is that there were these ambitious policies by Gaddafi that were more or less flawed, more or less well-meaning, didn't necessarily always have the support within Libya that you would need to go ahead with that.
Right.
I think the real sin here, as in many other cases, what I'm seeing, is that Gaddafi attempted to pursue an independent policy domestically and in terms of foreign policy. The problem was he tried to approach the United States as an equal. He wanted to meet them as equals, or even that they would have to pay respect to Libya and other African countries when they met. So that was one issue. He thought that he could negotiate deals with China, with the United States, however he wanted, however it worked with Libya. He could negotiate big group deals with the African Union, other African states. That didn't seem to be something that the United States would have considered acceptable.
No, you're absolutely right about that, in the sense that, you know, he wanted himself and by extension the rest of Libya and other African nations to be treated with the dignity that he felt deserved to be respected and recognized. What a number of people have pointed out is the kind of extensive investments that Libya had across Europe under Gaddafi, and that is also true. And that's also because after having suffered many years under European and American sanctions, after having paid the price for in terms of being isolated, Gaddafi was sort of putting into place mechanisms that would make any such move in the future impossible, or at least not possible without significant pain to those who wanted to bring the sanctions about. And that's why I was saying that he was buying the bed, for people who want to say he was in bed with the West. He was investing in all kinds of industries, in electoral campaigns, supposedly, especially in France, possibly in Italy as well, investing in Northern Ireland, investing in elsewhere in the UK, to sort of set up a foundation where he would make himself indispensable to them. And therefore, the idea that they could one day turn on him and impose sanctions and isolate him, that they wouldn't be able to do so without suffering a great deal.
Yes, imagine that, an African head of state getting involved in a European political process.
Exactly.
It's supposed to be the other way around. And you know, the 2003 onwards, there's this move towards the rest of the world, including the United States. I think Gaddafi committed, you know, even after trying to move towards the U.S., the same sin as Cuba and other countries that said, if you're going to invest in us, there's certain terms and conditions. If there's going to be foreign investment. So
that's right.
On the one hand, he's embarking an investment in Europe at a time when its economy is declining, giving it greater relative power, as you suggested. But on the other hand, he's putting conditions and terms on how foreign investment is conducted in Libya. And that's just a no-no. It doesn't matter who you are, what you believe, that is a no-no.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, you know, he made a number of American oil companies absolutely scream with panic, not because of his resource nationalism, which is something that was noted even during the so-called period of normalized and friendly relations with the U.S. that was, you know, at best illusory. But, for example, when the families of the Lockerbie victims were suing for more compensation, and the United States Senate was passing legislation to impose further fines and penalties on Libya, when Libya thought that that was in the past and that was dealt and done with, what Gaddafi did was, or one of his officials anyway, was to call in a group of American oil executives and tell them, you see these fines that your country is going to be putting on us, you're going to be the ones paying for them. They're going to come out of your profits. They're not going to come out of the out of Libyan coffers. Well, that is something, obviously, that they immediately reported to the U.S. ambassador and so on. So that was a kind of behind-the-scenes look at the real state of relations between the U.S. and Libya. That, again, isn't commonly, you know, reproduced in the media or even by people who ought to know better, I think.
That's exactly it. You see, I wish we had this kind of information in the lead up to the intervention when all sorts of ideas were being thrown around. Now, for those who are just tuning in, by the way, of course, we're speaking with Professor Maximilian Forte, an associate professor at Concordia University in anthropology. Maximilian Forte's recent book, Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa, details the lead-up to war, the motivations for war, policies of Gaddafi, some of the difficulties that were related to those policies, and the eventual outcome of that conflict. It's published by Baraka Books. It's absolutely essential. It came out this year. You'll be getting more information on this program about where to get that. And we're putting our good author here through quite a lot, through the whole rigmarole in terms of questioning. There's just so much content in this book. I think it is definitely the most definitive account possible. It's never going to be surpassed because you were able to collect all the information at that particular time and present it to us in a very clear format. Again, these were issues that were very difficult to discuss in the smokescreen, the fog of war immediately prior to the conflict. We all know how it was justified, as it's been discussed in this program already to some extent. We had to stop a massacre. We had to do something. And that's why I think CERT is a centerpiece of your book. It's the axis upon which the whole pro-war narrative turns into its opposite.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's, in fact, why I decided that after having heard so much about Benghazi in the early stages of the intervention, I realize that the real story that's taking place, the real story that needs to be told, is not the story of Benghazi so much, but it's a story of the city that leaders in Benghazi absolutely detested, and that's CERT itself. And so I used CERT as a kind of, well, first of all, as a way of managing an immense amount of information, using CERT as a kind of microcosm, but also because it really was, how do I put it, a sort of hub and a vital staging ground for all sorts of things that caused the United States in particular a great deal of alarm. It was the center for diplomatic activity where a lot of regional gatherings among African leaders took place. It was where immense investment was occurring and where American companies were seeking contracts to do business specifically in CERT, and so forth. And it's also the city that probably the city that suffered the most during the entire war in Libya that was basically virtually demolished and turned into a house of horrors that left most visiting journalists and human rights investigators in absolute, you know, shock, because they had only seen things like these in documentaries of Stalingrad and so forth. And virtually any photograph of search from that time, you know, backs up what their impressions were.
Yes, I think you had a lot of fun talking about the journalists that were covering CERT and the difficulty they had on getting much out. They were indeed shocked by what they saw, because the whole narrative of the conflict, as you point out so well throughout the book, is that massacres had to be stopped. They had to be stopped in Benghazi and elsewhere. There were no massacres. There was no evidence whatsoever that any massacres were going to take place through any organized state institution. But you did get massacres, rape, starvation, murder, all sorts of atrocities, shooting of civilians, torture, everything in CERT.
That's right, exactly. And we participated in that. We either participated in it directly, or we participated in it indirectly by arming, equipping, enabling, and otherwise empowering the kinds of local forces that would commit those atrocities. So the real story, I mean, this is the irony of it. It's a very cruel and extremely bitter irony. The real irony is that the calls for responsibility to protect should have come to prevent NATO's action in Libya, not to, you know, invite NATO into Libya.
It was kind of a backwards thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the need for a responsibility to protect, the need for a no-fly zone, the need to stop a massacre happens after the NATO intervention.
Exactly. But you know what's at work there? And it took me a little while to recognize the kind of logic, but it's used also with Syria. And because we're not dealing with people that are incredibly imaginative, it'll probably be used again. And the logic is this, and really your listeners should pay careful attention, because they're going to encounter this themselves quite a few times, I think. The logic is this. If we do not act, we in the West, let's say Canada, if we do not act, then we're just as good as if we were accomplices. We should be held accountable for the atrocities and the actions committed by others if we don't act. If we do act, we should never be held accountable for our own actions. And that's that kind of dualism that you constantly get. We're guilty for doing nothing, but when we do something, we should do so with impunity.
Right. We can get away with whatever it is that we're
absolutely
doing.
I mean, no one else is allowed to kill civilians, because that's our prerogative.
The massacres aren't happening even as they are happening. That's what Harold Pinter said in his address to the UN with regard to the war in Iraq.
You know, exactly.
When we're committing the massacre, we're not committing the massacre.
Yeah,
give us
exactly.
A Nobel Peace Prize. And I know it's almost time to wrap up. I mean, it leads right into your other points. I mean, the results of what happened in CERT, very much good news to the IPAD interventionists, because then it allows us to infantilize the people of Libya further and say, well, look how devastated it is. Now we're going to give handouts to these poor people. And as one U.S. official said post-regime change, you know, they're just learning to walk now.
Yeah, they're just learning. This is after they've had their legs cut off by the United States. Now you can say they're just learning to walk. But we constantly do this, don't we? I mean, we constantly create the suffering and then invent the need for our beneficence, for our humanitarian assistance. And even when we refer to our own violence, we talk about it in terms of being surgical, you know, as if we were healthcare providers, as if we weren't bombing civilian populations or civilian infrastructure and so forth. Or as in some of the cases that I also documented in the book, and documented to the point that no one really can dispute it, where U.S. forces deliberately, you know, these are the words they use when speaking about terrorists, where they deliberately and knowingly targeted civilians. And that was an established pattern. And that's no longer a matter for debate or for guessing or for accusations of conspiracy theory and so forth. That was done. And so no one has been held accountable for that. Meanwhile, Gaddafi was to be held accountable for things that he never even did. which is just, you know, absolutely astounding.
Yes, on the previous programs, we covered the Viagra accusations, for example, which, as you point out in the book, that story had legs even after it was disproven. It was just repeated over and over again. We're dealing with a very strong case of an echo chamber in which Twitter references Al Jazeera, which references CNN, and so a story becomes a verified fact. We're seeing that with regard to Syria as well. And as the Syrians say, you know, NATO puts itself as the arsonist and the fireman.
Absolutely. That's a perfect way of putting it.
But I know it's almost time to wrap up. I guess just closing out, you point out that there is a sort of north-south division among the left that was revealed through this conflict. The Latin Americans were saying that Libya's sovereignty had to be respected and so on. And people who agreed with them here in the West were criticized for having a reflexive anti-imperialism. Don't you think maybe anti-imperialism is a good reflex to have?
I wish more people exercise themselves to the point where they have that kind of reflex, because it's in short supply. But the thing is about Latin America is that, you know, they've experienced colonialism for hundreds of years in their history, and they've been living subject to the United States. They have witnessed numerous invasions and occupations. You have leaders like Fidel Castro, who has been targeted with over 600 CIA assassination attempts. I mean, this is almost on the level of daily routine now. These are people who have a firsthand, deeply ingrained sense of imperialism and how it works, enough to be able to recognize patterns from early on, and they should have been respected a lot more from the beginning, from outsiders, from people such as myself and others, to say, listen, this isn't kind of just paranoia here. Born of experience, leaders such as Castro, Ortega in Nicaragua, and Chavez in Venezuela, all of whom have been targeted by various U.S. plots and wars and so forth. Let's listen to what they have to say, because they've had first-hand experience. They can recognize things when they're in motion, and they can sniff things out much better than, you know, some blogger in the U.K.
No, we should have given the Latin American leaders more credence. They turned out to be more right than their critics. Conversely, all the people who said that there would be no intervention, you know, that they said they thought they knew the character and composition of the Libyan rebels and how nice things would be after the intervention. I mean, they're not being put on a podium to be asked questions about. They don't have to apologize for what they've done.
No, absolutely. This is the interesting thing, is that even to this day, those who have been proven right in their criticisms of the intervention in Libya, we're still being asked to apologize for what I don't know. But individuals such as, you know, people even that I've respected, people such as Emmanuel Wallerstein, who wrote articles severely criticizing Chavez and saying that Chavez's political analysis is all wrong, that there's not going to be any Western military intervention in Libya at all. Within a few weeks, he was proven wrong. I didn't see Emmanuel Wallerstein issue any kind of retraction and saying, sorry, I was wrong. Maybe I should go back and re-examine my own analytical framework.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. When theory is inconsistent with reality, you're supposed to reevaluate the theory. But I guess we're extreme radicals for pointing that out.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it was nice talking with an extreme radical such as yourself. I want to thank you, and thank you for writing this book. Again, for our listeners, that's Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa by Maximilian C. Forte, published by Baracco Books 2012. We'll provide a link on the website for this. It's a must read. I think it's one of the most important books of the year. There are books about capitalism and the market that people should read. There are books about development, the latest on international development that people should read. And this book about Libya and the potential for this script to be used again as it is being used in Syria is of the utmost importance. And I think there's one book you want to read before the end of the year that you can just order. It's definitely Slouching Towards CERT, NATO's War on Libya and Africa. So, Professor Forte, thanks so much for being on the program with us today.
And thank you very much, Brendan. It was great, as always, to be with you.
Thanks, Max.
All right, take care.
That was Maximilian C. Forte. Again, professor of anthropology at Concordia University. He has been covering the buildup to war with Libya